This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
We are picking up our study where we left off, and before we begin, let me tell you, my heart's desire is that this is not a science lesson, or a lesson in geology, or maybe a few facts from paleontology or whatever, but that God will reinforce and encourage the faith of those of you who believe the biblical record of Scripture relative to the creation. And for those of you that are wondering and searching and asking, that this will be one more seed of truth that God will deposit in your heart to give you something to consider as you consider our reasonable faith and the record of our great and inspired book. From our research, as we go back into this series in Living Color, we've discovered that there are numerous elements necessary for life to be possible on planet Earth, and it takes a remarkable amount of precision, whether it's oxygen or nitrogen or phosphorus or carbon, whether it's the size of the sun and the distance from Earth, whether it's our personal moon orbiting us at just the right distance and speed, creating just the amount of gravitational pressure and tides, which allow seasons. All of these are needed to be in existence at just the right time in order to sustain life. And one of the texts that we've looked at, and I've mentioned it a couple of times, I hope you've noted in your Bible somewhere, or maybe even gone to Isaiah 45 and verse 18 and underlined it. This is where Isaiah the prophet is quoting God, who says, he informs us that he has created the earth to be inhabited, and he references the universe as uninhabitable. In fact, Isaiah calls it a waste place. Definitely has purposes beyond probably what we could even imagine in balancing the universe, for one thing. But he uniquely created, Isaiah says, earth to be inhabited. And I found it interesting after a couple of weeks ago when we talked about this, going home and the very next day being sort of deluged by the news media that's now quoting this one NASA scientist who said, and I thought it was rather intriguing the way the headline read, without any evidence, one NASA scientist believes we have been visited by aliens. And this is going to become the growing religious faith statement that seeks to answer what Darwinism has failed to answer. Because Darwin knew nothing of a complex cell. He knew nothing of DNA. And there has to be a designer behind all this design. So now, well, we don't have to look to God. There's somebody that's probably seeded the earth a long time ago, some alien race somewhere. So they're pointed, again, not in the direction of a creator God, but they hope in something else. Well, the odds of planet Earth just so happening to have all the elements necessary without a designer is staggering. Because even if you did have that discovery of the alien race who just kicked the can further down the road, where did they come from? Where did that start? Where's the genesis of that? Let me illustrate the uniqueness of Earth this way. Suppose you take out of your piggy bank a quarter, and at this season you probably don't have any left, but suppose you do have one, and you wrote on it a number one, numeral one. Then you took another quarter out and you wrote on it numeral two, a third quarter, now you're dipping into your wife's purse to find the third one, but you number that three. Number four, five, six, seven. Until you have seven quarters, and you've numbered them each by a numeral from one to seven. Now, the statistical odds of this earth being undesigned, the result of random accidents, instead of viably being created for life, could be illustrated this way. Suppose you were able to bring truckloads of quarters onto this campus and unload them in this auditorium so that you spread them across the floor 3 feet deep. Well, actually, in order to be consistent with the statistical possibility, you're not going to cover the floor of this auditorium with quarters. You're going to cover North Carolina with quarters 3 feet deep. Then somebody from Washington, D.C. takes your 7 quarters away from you. That doesn't take much imagination, but they take your quarters away from you. And then they tell you that they're going to place them somewhere in North Carolina at 7 different locations, and they're going to blindfold you, and you have one chance to reach down the first time and pick up the quarter marked number 1. And you have one chance to pick up the 2nd quarter in order that's marked number 2, and so forth. And so you're up for it. Besides, you need those 7 quarters back. And so they provided a helicopter, and you get into that helicopter, and you think a moment, and then you tell that pilot, look, why don't you fly me over to Asheville? I know that area a little bit. And so he takes you there, and he touches down. And by the way, you've also been blindfolded. I don't know if I mentioned that, but we have to make this consistent statistically. So you're blindfolded. You drop down into Asheville, and you wait around in 3 feet of quarters, and then you say, I'm going to put my hand in right here, and you pull out number 1. Wow. That'd be pretty amazing. You get back into the helicopter, and you tell the pilot, you know, let's fly over to Manteo, and you drop down in there, and you wade through 3 feet of quarters, and eventually you reach out, and you pick out a quarter, and wouldn't you know it, it's number 2. And then you tell the pilot, look, let's fly over to Charlotte. You drop down, do the same thing. You reach down and you pick up the quarter that's marked number 3. And then you decide to fly to Carthage. You don't know why, but Carthage came to mind. So you drop down into Carthage and you pick up the first time you reached out, and the first quarter you reached to pick out in Carthage was numbered 4. And so forth. Until you've found all 7 in order. Now, I don't know about you, but I can't find my wallet in my house. And I'm not blindfolded. Can you imagine finding in order all 7 quarters and only those 7 quarters in numerical order? That's the same statistical odds of Earth being somehow properly ordered just perfectly for you to take your next breath and to not fly off this planet into outer space. And we ran out of time in our last study on the subject that addresses the question, if God, according to the Bible, if it really happened that he created by the word of his power, if he created the world and the universe, he spoke, and it was so, according to the Genesis account and the genealogies, which would place Earth at right about 8,000 years of age. Well, if that's true, then why does the Earth look so much older? That's a legitimate question to answer. We began by being reminded that Earth is considered old only if you hold to the evolutionary worldview of uniformitarianism. And what that may, you may remember, means is that whatever has been happening, observed in nature, in the world, in the universe, it has always been happening that same way. And so we come up with the evolutionary birth date of planet Earth, which evolutionists put at 4.5 billion years. I don't know where the 0.5 came from, but it's 4.5 billion years old. I mean, look, if it takes that drip of water 1,000 years to wear out that granite stone, then based on that observation and a uniformitarian worldview, then if it's left alone to do that, in about 6 million years, you'll have the Grand Canyon. Because that's how long it would take, based on what we can observe. With regional flooding and the erosion of rock and sediment by the Colorado River, It took supposedly 6 million years to pull out that stunning piece of real estate that you may have visited. But again, that's assuming the normal rate of erosion, which we can measure under normal circumstances. But what if something happened that doesn't normally happen, that turns that time scale upside down? And then we were able to get into just a little bit the earth experiencing something that had never happened before, according to the Bible. In fact, God promised that it would never happen again, and it was the global flood. Now, in Genesis chapter 7, if you want to turn there, we'll drop back in there fairly quickly, sort of get a running start. This is all just sort of a refresher course. Remember, if this is a regional flood, then Jesus was sadly misinformed, because in one of his sermons recorded in Luke chapter 17, he said that the flood of Noah destroyed all of humanity, the entire human race. Furthermore, not only is Jesus misinformed, that isn't bad enough, and that would be bad enough, but God the Father lied to Noah, because God the Father told Noah, this isn't going to happen again. But if it was a regional flood or a local flood, he lied, because that happens every year in places around our country. Well, according to Moses' record at Genesis chapter 7, if you drop down in the middle part of verse 11, Moses records, the fountains of the great deep burst open, and the floodgates of the sky were opened. The rain fell upon the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. By the way, keep in mind, the water's going to be all covering the surface. It'll take a long time to recede, about 5 or 6 months. Noah and his family will remain on that ark for a year. It's often overlooked even among believers. They're on that ark for about a year. I know they were glad to finally get out of that van when God finally opened the door. We're told the rain fell upon the earth. In verse 18, drop down there, the water prevailed and increased greatly upon the earth. Verse 19, little part, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered. Thus God, verse 23, drop there, thus God blotted out every living thing that was upon the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, they were blotted out from the earth. Last part of verse 23. Only Noah was left, together with those that were with him in the ark. The fountains of the great deep burst open. There are volumes in that phrase. In other words, great volcanic eruptions took place globally. Channels of water beneath the surface of the earth, beneath the ocean floor, suddenly on God's cue, erupted with seismic power and destructive energy, while rain all along is pouring down for 40 days and 40 nights. We can't imagine the tumbling of Earth's surface by the massive flooding and erosion. By one author said, the tsunamis that resulted from underwater plate shifting, sending great walls of water racing across the continents, leveling everything in sight. As the continents uplifted and shifted, the poets David and Asaph tell us that mountain chains arose, that is, they were buckling upward. Entire mountain ranges would have been forced upward, virtually crafted together. During the days of Noah and this flood, the topography being much different than it is now, mountains not nearly as tall. By the way, it's interesting to discover that Mount Ararat, you may remember that mountain, because that's where the ark came to rest. That mountain is made of molten lava, like many of the mountain ranges in the Pacific Northwest, here in our own country. They're called volcanic mountains. They're the result of multiple eruptions. Mount Ararat, imagine this, was literally formed, pushed upward during the flood by molten lava deep inside the earth's crust, erupting on cue from God, which gave the ark that resting place. It's interesting that there is the presence of marine fossils on the mountain range of Mount Ararat near the peaks. Even Mount Everest, one study I encountered documented, they have found ocean fossils near its peak. This is 29,000 feet above sea level. This is the tallest point on planet Earth. Fossils of fish at the highest mountain peak on Earth's surface. How did fish get up there? Well, even the evolutionary world is allowing, in my lifetime, more and more credence to the idea of what they call catastrophism. That is, some catastrophe from ancient days, we don't quite know where to put it, where millions of animals were fossilized quickly, sediment laid down on a global scale. This is what I would say is a wonderful evidence of geology catching up with Genesis. I can remember when our twin sons were in first grade, we had them in a public magnet school in Raleigh. And one night at the dinner table, the boys told us that a scientist, actually a paleontologist, was going to come to school the next day with dinosaur fossils and give a presentation. So I decided to go to school the next day to listen to the presentation, so I could be prepared to talk about what they would have heard that day at school. The specialist got up. He was in front of the entire elementary school. They were sort of packed in semicircular form around the specialist at a table with some really cool-looking fossils. And it was just packed. I stood at the back under the balcony alcove. I didn't tell my boys I'd be there. I didn't want them to know I was there. I just wanted to be prepared for that evening. I'd have a little time to, you know, bone up on my study before they got home for supper. At the end of the presentation, the specialist said, you know, we're not sure what caused so many dinosaurs to be killed around the same time and then go extinct soon after. We really don't know what happened. And at that moment, Seth, one of my boys, raised his hand. And I thought, why is he raising his hand? The scientist has not asked for questions and answers. And I just kind of held my breath, and the scientist spotted him and said, yes, son. And he just kind of hollered out, it was the flood. That's my son. Go get him. My favorite child for at least a week. You know, the expert in that field graciously responded. I found it very interesting. He said to Seth and to all those children, that may be. That may be. He said, there are more and more people in my field considering some kind of catastrophe as an explanation. We're given the details of the explanation here in this catastrophic event recorded in Genesis, where earth was tumbled and refashioned, mountains were pushed up, ocean valleys and river basins and canyons created and carved out for a new planet that, here's my point, that suddenly looked much older than it was. There are still many intriguing questions. I've encountered more of them than we'll ever get into. In fact, this is our last session on this particular subject, and we're going to finish the series by talking about the new creation. But one question that I've done a lot of reading on relates to coal, which supposedly, again, on an evolutionary timescale, takes 300 million years to form. So if we have coal mines, it took 300 million years. So Earth's got to be at least that old. And of course, the sedimentary layers that you can see on the sides of canyon walls, it takes so long for those layers to be formed one on top of another. So where is the evidence of something like these things being formed quickly? Well, you know, it's really interesting to me that we happen to be living in a generation where evidence has been provided in a remarkable manner. And I don't know if that's because we're the last generation and everything Jesus has predicted about the next judgment is not that far off. I find it intriguing that in my lifetime, evidence I'm going to show you in a minute has been discovered, while at the same time, a guy in his organization builds a replica of the Ark just to remind the world, hey, this happened, and the next judgment is going to happen as well. Well, it's as if God said, I'm going to reveal some evidence, especially in this generation. In fact, one author, secular author, said this is the greatest geological event in 100 years. Another secular author called it the most catastrophic event ever recorded in the history of the United States. It became, by the way, nothing less than a laboratory to study the results of a massive eruption and what can happen quickly by means of flooding. I'm referring to the volcanic eruption of Mount St. Helens in Washington State. The geological community, primarily driven by evolution and uniformitarianism, made amazing observations, by the way, discoveries, but never connected the dots between the evidence staring them in the face with the evidence and declaration of a global flood and what it can do to a young earth. You know, as I researched this particular event, I couldn't help but think of the Apostle Paul's description of our world and the intelligence of our world when he wrote, "They are always learning, never able to come to the knowledge of the truth." Always learning. Never able to connect the dots. Let me give you something right out of the script, as if it came from Genesis chapter 7. It occurred only a few decades ago in a regional manner. And along the way, I want to connect some dots. On May 18th, 1980, this beautiful setting of Mount St. Helens and Spirit Lake at its base was dramatically altered. Mount St. Helens erupted, and the top and the side of the mountain literally blew off in a massive explosion that equaled the detonation of several nuclear bombs. The blast from Mount St. Helens traveled at 650 miles an hour, and it destroyed the forests, get this, in the surrounding 230 square miles. If you can imagine it, this blast, this explosion leveled 3 billion feet of timber, knocking it over like bowling pins in less than 10 minutes. That's how fast it happened. One report said that Douglas fir trees, 200 feet tall, were snapped like toothpicks. The timber leveled by the blast was enough to build 600,000 homes. This was huge. As some of the side of Mount St. Helens literally cannonballed into Spirit Lake, it displaced the water, creating waves 800 feet high. That's high. The water from the lake rushed up the surrounding forest regions where all the trees are now knocked down. And then as the water returned back to Spirit Lake, it carried with it an estimated 4 million trees, creating this massive log mat. It's going to be significant because one of the most shocking results was discovered 5 years later in 1985, where all that timber had intermingled suddenly with volcanic sediment. Now, up until then, the prevailing viewpoint was that it took 300 million years to form coal, and yet here in Spirit Lake, They had sections of timber below the mat where timber had sunk, creating a 300-foot deep mat. So with fire, pressure, lava, rock, and all of that, guess what you had in Spirit Lake? The formation of coal. In fact, they found one log that on one end of it, it was petrified. That's supposed to take a long time. And the other end of the same log had the beginning formation of coal. Right there in Spirit Lake, which, by the way, I think is wonderfully named. Not the evil spirit the Indians named it after, but the true Spirit of God, who, as it were, is giving evidence again in living color of his creation. The standard geological viewpoint, by the way, is that it takes 1,000 years to form 1 inch of coal. 1,000 years for 1 inch. In Spirit Lake you have right now, 3 feet of coal being formed. So let's connect the dots. Just imagine what a global flood did 4,000 years ago. Imagine what it did to Earth's vegetation and trees. Imagine the massive volcanic eruptions Moses records for us around the globe. Imagine all of the forests of the Earth, not a few, not in the Northwest, all of them immediately uprooted, blown over, all the forests immediately tumbled together with lava and sediment and heat and water and pressure. The coal beds we have had ample time to be formed in 4,000 years for what we are now mining on the planet. By the way, I want to make another point on something that reaffirms the Genesis flood and the young age of the earth. Let me throw in here something that the news did not report. You never saw this on TV. It never made it into your children's geology book. But in June of 1992, roughly 12 years later, volcanic rock that had been formed by this eruption was taken from this site at Mount St. Helens and put to the standard radiometric testing to date it. And the rocks that were only 10 years old, 10 to 12 years old, were, by using the standard methods of dating, determined to be 350,000 years old. And get this, one report admitted that the minerals packed inside the rock during the eruption were dated using the standard radiometric dating processes, were dated to be 2.8 million years old. And they're barely more than 10 years old. Geologists were stunned. In fact, two of them that wrote a report that I scanned went on to say, courageously, I thought, and publicly, uniformitarianism and Darwinism is hindering our studies in geology. Today, the top of Mount St. Helens is gone. It blew sediment and ash, by the way, 16 miles high. You can imagine that. Closed airports impacted 11 surrounding states. I've had people in earlier services this morning tell me they were in that region. They saw the results. Topography was instantly crafted, entirely changed. If you stumbled across this scenery right here at the base and stretching out from Mount St. Helens, you would date it at taking millions of years to carve out those canyons. But if Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980 wasn't enough to get our attention, if it wasn't enough to impact the religious faith declarations of Darwinism and uniformitarianism, God in his patience designed yet another eruption to take place 24 months later. And this one received even less of an effort to connect the dots. By now, that crater at the top of Mount St. Helens had formed ice, and yet that eruption immediately turned that ice into a flow mixed with lava and rock. It became the largest debris avalanche in the history of the United States. In fact, one author said it's the largest debris avalanche we have recorded in all of human history. Of course, if you don't, you know, take into account this one, this would be the largest. But in 1982, this ice, lava, and mud flow initially traveled 40 miles an hour, at some points 90 miles an hour. It changed the topography of 23 square miles. It carved out canyons with elevated plateaus. It cut through bedrock at its deepest points, some 600 feet deep. And it created a 1/40th scale model of the Grand Canyon. And this could be tedious, but I want you to follow this because this point here alone is significant. According to the evolutionary timescale model, it took 6 million years, remember, for the Colorado River to carve out, with the water flowing over the plateaus as well, the Grand Canyon. 6 million years. Now, you have the results of a massive avalanche that has created something 1/40th the size of the Grand Canyon. So if you pull out your calculator like I did and you do the math, it should take around 150,000 years to create the canyons outside the region of Mount St. Helens. But you can drive over there right now and see them. Didn't take 150,000 years after all, unless we're much older than we are. Granite canyon walls were supposed to take 6 million years to be carved by water. Geologists watched some of these canyon walls of granite at one point 140 feet deep, solid granite, cut away in less than one day. Less than one day. Coal, again, that should take 300 million years to form. It's forming in Spirit Lake. In fact, in one of the canyons formed by the second eruption, I got a picture, there's a guy in a red sweater there. He's standing at the base of one of the canyon walls carved out in a matter of days by the second eruption of Mount St. Helens. And this particular canyon wall, I wanted to show you the picture because you can see the strata of sedimentary layers. According to uniformitarianism and evolutionary thought, you have to have a million years between each layer of strata. So you can just start counting the millions of years that supposedly it took for this to be formed. One article I read said that the canyon wall showed the strata of sedimentary layers perfectly and symmetrically laid down in a matter of hours. Another article, a geologist was staggered that sediment layers could be 600 feet thick, yet separated into distinct strata, even though this avalanche was moving at 40 miles an hour. Evolutionary Darwinism has been printing in textbooks for years that it takes 1 million years between each layer, so I would assume they're going to rewrite the textbooks. Was there a great revival, beloved, in Washington State? Has there been a rush to redo the geological standards of radiometric dating? Has there been an acknowledgement in school books and online scientific resources, which you can look up just as much as easily as I could, that the Grand Canyon could have been formed in a couple of years because of what they saw happening in 1 month? No. In fact, I went online last night. You know, I was supposed to preach this 2 weeks ago, so maybe the data changed. And I Googled, how long did it take to form the Grand Canyon? And up pops at the very top of that screen a beautiful box, picture of the Grand Canyon next to it, in big, bold numerics and letters. It reads, the answer, 6 million years. No question mark. It's a statement of faith. And then I went ahead and I Googled, how long does it take for coal to form? And the answer popped up again, large letters, 300 million years. Always learning. Never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. Why? Because it would point you back to a creator who designed the planet, who has promised judgment. It came and it's coming again. I uncovered one article, by the way, about a man. This was very sad to me to read this. He operated a lodge for more than 50 years in that region. He was located a mile away from Mount St. Helens. And he became a folk hero among the people of this region because he refused to evacuate. Mount St. Helens had been giving off for months and months warnings, rumblings, vapor. They knew it was going to erupt. There had been plenty of time and warning given just about everybody else. In fact, everyone else in his area and beyond had evacuated before 8:32 a.m. on May 18th, 1980. But this old man became a brave hero. In fact, there's a picture of him. You could see him. He's sitting out on his porch. And if there had been social media in 1980, I don't know how they got along without it back then, but if there had been social media back then, it would have gone viral with his recorded statement, his statement to a reporter that said, quote, "That mountain is a mile away. That mountain ain't going to hurt me." End quote. Within 10 minutes of the eruption, he and his lodge were buried 150 feet deep. God issued a warning through Noah. It would take 120 years to build the ark, and nobody reserved a seat besides his family. God has issued a warning through Peter that another judgment of fire is coming. That warning's lasted now about 2,000 years. In fact, I'm going to turn to that warning in 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 3, and I'm going to work my way very quickly through this. But Peter says this, "Know this first of all, that in the last days mockers will come with their mockings, saying, all continues just as it was from the beginning of ancient past creation time." What are they saying? They're declaring their faith in the doctrine of uniformitarianism. We believe that everything is continuing in the same way as it's always continued since the beginning of time. Everything that's happened is what always happens, and nothing that usually doesn't happen isn't going to happen. And Peter takes that statement of faith and connects the dots. He says, "For when they maintain this, it escapes their notice." Haven't they noticed that by the word of God, the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water? But by his word, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, kept for the day of judgment. The heavens, that is the universe, will be destroyed by burning, and the elements will melt with intense heat. You know how ridiculous that sounds to our world? As ridiculous as it sounded when Noah said, it's going to rain and flood everything. And if you don't get on this boat, you're going to drown. The next global judgment will not be water, but fire. Listen, let's just take God at his word. Reserve a seat. This time on the living ark, who is the Lord Jesus. That's the only way you're going to emerge safely following the great judgment of God upon the human race. In fact, the entire creation which has fallen, and he's going to recreate. How? Through billions of years of time? No, by the word of his mouth. He's going to speak again, And a new earth will be created and a new universe. The scriptures tell us. And listen, if you have trouble with that first creation and that first judgment, can you imagine the next judgment and the power of Christ to recreate the universe all over again? Only this time it will be eternal, immortal, perfect, in living color like we have never seen color before. Have you reserved a seat on the living ark, who is Christ? You know, our world is very happy, especially at this season, to think of Jesus as a baby. He's much safer as a little baby boy in a manger. Isn't that cute? And if you get much beyond that, we really want to put him on a cross and leave him there. But he didn't stay in the manger, and he didn't stay on the cross. He died and rose again so that you could have that seat reserved. And he then ascended to the Father. He's in the seat of glory, and he is coming back again. He will judge all of humanity of all time. Following that judgment, this universe will explode in a fiery ball, and we will watch him with the word of his mouth speak. This time we get to be there. To hear him say, "Let there be light." And there was light. We're going to get to see that one. If you've reserved a place in the living ark, who is Christ. I want to talk about that new creation, the Father's house, new earth. I brought a picture along to show you a little bit of the scale by what we've been given in the Bible. You've got a little dot there that shows the Tower of Dubai. That's the tallest thing mankind's produced so far. Next to that, you've got Mount Everest. Next to that, you have the Father's house, 11 miles square, 11 miles high. That's your future home. That's the place that Jesus has prepared. You've got a room there. I've often thought, I hope I get a window. You've got a room there, a place. That'll be home base from which you then for all of eternity go on assignment by your Creator God to explore the new earth and the new universe. Father, thank you for your word and the record of Scripture. We're grateful for science and geology and paleontology. We're grateful for believers who are invested in those worlds, making discovery and observation. We thank you for the medical community. I've spotted even in here, Lord, a doctor who has studied mitochondrial DNA. We know as believers that these staggering observations point to you, our Creator God. But we're in a world, much like Noah, who rejects the warning. So would you help us? Would you enable us and strengthen us as we leave this place and enter our world to be good testimonies, to express our belief in the real Christmas narrative? Maybe you'll give us opportunities with friends and neighbors and family and coworkers to deliver to them some of our own testimony so that they might be brought to safety, not only to be given a life worth living, but life beyond this one that's safe and immortal and eternal and glorious in the splendor of your new creation. Thank you for your love in that you died for us to make this possible. It's free to us because it cost you, Lord, everything. And we want to thank you. And we do in Jesus' name.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.